That's right. Memento viveri. Remember, we must live. Remember, we must live. What's up, Dragon Riders? Welcome back to Riding with Dragons. On this episode, I will be featuring a dear sister who also has a podcast. Her name is Tanya, and her podcast is Wisdom Drops. And today, we're going to be talking about building garden systems in public schools, in low-income public schools, specifically her experience doing that work in Chicago.
Oh snap, hello.
Hello, we are here. All right, so we have today, on today's episode of Riding with Dragons, hello, I am Trinette T. I'm your host. And today I have with me Wisdom Drops, another anchor podcast, and my beloved dear sister, Tanya, who is going to be talking with me today about her experience building garden programs in Chicago public schools. Hey, Tanya, you want to tell our audience a little bit about you and our connection?
Hey, Trinette. Well, first off, thank you so much for having me on. I'm the first interviewee, right, of Riding with Dragons.
You are the first interviewee. And also, let me insert this. You guys will be hearing Tanya's voice a lot. Her and I do this Wisdom Drops Jazz, where we get together and we just drop bombs about astrology and how that's relating to the world and really translating it down in a language that's alchemical and that you can understand and is progressive and really honors free will and sovereignty. And we'll be having many episodes together, collabing, doing that kind of jive in and sharing medicine and message with y'all. But today we're talking about something a little bit different. We're really talking about the experience of Tanya's particular realm of dragon riding mastery when it comes to making stuff happen in the dense environment of the Chicago public school system. So yes, that's my little interlude. And Tanya, go ahead, continue. Tell us about yourself.
Well, Sister Chinetti, you are not lying. It is dense. Dense is the perfect word to describe the Chicago public schools system as a whole and trying to work within it as a change maker. But yeah, a little bit about myself. Thank you so much. First off, I'm honored to be your first interviewee on Riding with Dragons. This is awesome. I'm very excited to be on this platform with you today. And thank you for bringing important, you know, information forward about this topic, because so much is there, right? And we'll dive into it. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but yeah, a little about myself, just as a introduction for anybody listening, like, who is this chick, you know? I basically have worked in Chicago for 10 years professionally in the world of community gardening, environmental education, urban agriculture, and just generally working on youth programs the whole time throughout that process. And so just a quick overview maybe of my education. You know, I started at Columbia College Chicago because I came from a very rural environment, like a road of 100 people. And I was like, we need to fix this food system. So I went to the city, this country mouse to the city, to learn about public relations and how to sell people more kashi. Something. And that's the way to heal. You know, we need to buy more organic food. Let's sell the kashi. And then 2 years into that, a student group I was a part of, EPIC, the Environmental Protection Initiative at Columbia, we petitioned the school to put in a rooftop garden. And we had hundreds of signatures from students. And we were actually kicked out of the engineer's office when it came up to proposing this idea. And he was very angry at us. So, you know, the CPS point is the focal point of this conversation. But we're kind of painting a landscape through my divergence here on just kind of like the larger culture of Chicago. If I can really paint with like a big bold brush, there's so many change makers. I don't want to, you know, portray anything, you know, negatively that needs not be. But, you know, so with that said, there was this contention around food access. And I left that environment because I figured out we need to highlight the truth. And PR is more often than not about highlighting points that serve businesses' bottom lines without really highlighting points that serve people's underlying well-being. And so I found myself moving to DePaul University and got my degree in geography, nature, and society, where I learned all about Marxist geography is really kind of who trained me, Marxist geographers. And I learned about the societal layers and the systems that go into creating not only, you know, lack of food access, but lack of fresh food access. And also just the societal layers of history that we have collectively inherited around these topics of healthy food and around, you know, different communities' interactions to that. So I don't want to get too, you know, in depth here, but I'll just quickly wrap up with my professional experience since. I've worked for some citywide programming like Chicago Green Corps Youth Program. That was a really significant part of my experience with the city as a whole in engaging with youth. And I also worked on the north end of the city in a community called Rogers Park, which I'm sure Trinetti will be telling us more about, seeing as that's part of where she grew up. But I worked in that community for the nonprofit sector and a couple different nonprofits and different angles. But that's kind of the overview of who I am and where I've been with my work. Does that serve the purpose, Tren?
Oh, yes, totally. That is perfect. Cool. And yeah, I want to just kind of put in a little bit about what was your, so how did you end up getting into the Chicago public school system and creating garden programs in the first place?
Well, when I first got into the Chicago public school system, I think my first real introduction was Green Corps Chicago Youth Program that I mentioned earlier. That was a program that was, unfortunately, it's since ended, but the parent program, Green Corps Chicago, is still present. Just a quick overview for listeners who have never heard of this program, so they have some type of understanding. The parent program, Green Corps, is designed to work with adults who have been previously incarcerated. And basically they say, hey, you just got out of prison. Do you want to learn how to be a green worker, like somebody who works in landscaping, somebody who works in tree care? Okay, those types of fields. And then they pay those people who came out of prison to learn how to do those skills if they don't already know them. And then they help them get jobs and place them at jobs. So the youth component of this program was a new thing. And I was fortunate enough to be involved for its inception as an instructor in the program. And so its first year I was an instructor, and I went on to be an instructor in the second year of the program. And the third year of the program I was a co-coordinator of the program itself. And the fourth year, unfortunately, I wasn't involved anymore because my other position demanded, you know, my time be there. But anyway, the youth program was birthed out of that parent program as a way of saying, hey, you know, there's clearly a cycle, there's a school to prison pipeline here, and what do we do about it? How do we prevent, you know, working with these people as adults? Well, let's work with them when they're kids before they get the chance to get locked up is basically, you know, the logic. So, yeah, that program, it was really vital. I hold it up as a model, really, for how we can do this. Environmental education and healing, you know, really is what it is healing the connection between people of color and the earth and all people and the earth, you know, really. But, you know, to answer your question, Trent, they had satellite locations in order to run programming. It was funded through Mayor Emanuel's office. To the office's credit, this was probably the dopest. But, you know, they had satellite locations for the programming over the summer months at different schools. And these schools were all CPS schools. So, and most of those schools, the vast majority of them, were on the south side and the west side of Chicago, with only a couple being stationed on the north side. And also in the north side locations, it was in communities such as Rogers Park with Sullivan High School, you know, where there still was tension, there still was issues that we face still in these communities. Like there was, in other words, they were all in communities of majority color, or with exception of Rogers Park. Rogers Park, I won't get off on a tangent, but it is the second most ethnically diverse Chicago community area.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. In this entire city.
Yeah.
So it's rich in its culture. And it also has its problems, you know, like any community, but there's been systematic divestment, you know, from that community as well. But I digress. I want to go with what you want to go with next. Trent, I don't want to get off.
No, yeah. You know, we can just ride this dragon wherever it wants to take us, because we don't really know where the medicine is, you know, until we get there. But piggybacking off of what you were talking about Rogers Park, that's I grew up in two different neighborhoods in Chicago. When I was really little, I was on the south side in Inglewood. And then in like my like late elementary school years into middle school years, I was in Rogers Park, where Tanya is talking about. And this was a blessing to grow up in a community that was so diverse. And there literally, I went to school with everybody and got to like taste food from all these different cultures, going to different friends' houses. It's such a beautiful, diverse community. But it also shows you that systematic oppression is it's really bigger than color. Like, it primarily affects African-American people and Latino people, but when there are other cultural communities that are intersecting with those communities in these areas and like what like the system calls low-income communities, it impacts everyone, and everyone starts to, who grows up in that environment, gets the equal treatment, is equally at risk to being subjected to violence, to being manipulated to get into gangs. Gangs target children. They don't go after adults. They go after young, malleable minds to get people into these toxic environments. And it was just, even though that community was so diverse, it was still it was an urban jungle. It was a danger zone. Every day that you left your house to walk to school, there was like a chance that somebody was going to try to attack you or try to like get you to try some drug or try to get you to run an errand for their like gang or like anything like that. Or like gang wars would like break out on the playground, and after school it'd be like a full like literal like medieval war zone that would break out. And this is the climate that these children are growing up in. And the teachers, they are probably like some of the biggest superheroes that you can ever meet, because that they even stay to hold space for that. And then they're so stretched thin that they can't even do what is needed to create more resources, to create safety nets, and honestly like positive distractions to focus the children's energy away from the streets and away from the violence and away from all of the traps that are there. Because what Tanya is saying is like absolutely true. Like, there are so many, like the way that Chicago public school systems, even just the social cultural etiquette of how they bring children in and out of school, it is similar to a prison.
Absolutely.
And it is modeling and shaping and preparing basically kids just for that. And the ratio of like statistical probability that by the sixth or seventh grade that the young African-American and Hispanic men will experience juvenile incarceration is exponentially higher. I don't even need to see statistics. I know it from experience. It's exponentially higher than in a suburban community. Like, where that's not even really a thought. It was a regular daily conversation about which one of our friends wasn't at school because they were currently in juvie.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah. So that was a thing and still is a thing, unfortunately. Like, for me, that was in the 90s. And here we are, like, literally, like, what, like 20 years later? And that's right. Like, still a thing that's happening. And the programs that Tanya created and was a part of creating were to counter that, were to help shake loose that system and bring children back into the softness and the memory and gentleness with the land. And you were, in fact, working in one of the schools that was a very like big part of my childhood, Gale Elementary, correct?
Yes, and isn't that so trippy and cosmically ordained? I like never fail to be amazed that I synchronistically ended up working for that environment in that school that you went to. That's
yeah,
so
I didn't actually go to Gale, but I went to Eugene Field Elementary School, and everyone hung out. Yeah, it was like they were our neighbor elementary school, so we would like go back and forth and hang out with each other, and kids would transfer back and forth depending on like where they moved, because certain like I think Tui was like the district border, and so people would end up switching back and forth, so it was kind of like one school with two campuses, if you will.
Got you. But you ended up, you were playing on those playgrounds.
Yes, I played on those playgrounds. I witnessed drive-bys on those playgrounds.
I'm sure you did.
All sorts of things happened on those playgrounds.
Oh yeah, it's still happening.
Yeah, so I remember, so Talia and I, we were really really close sisters. We even though we don't get to see each other a lot in the physical, we stay in dialogue with each other like more closely than some of some of the people that I do see more on a regular basis. And when Tanya was in process creating this garden programs in Gale Elementary School, I like witnessed through our conversations and just like so much ridiculous like tension and like resistance that you were up against with the administration. Can you tell us a little bit more about like what that was like being trying to do something so prolific and beautiful and being met with resistance?
Absolutely. I'm gonna answer it from like a broader perspective, like not just that school, but in general across my experience with Green Corps. Like we probably worked with 30 given schools, between 20 and 30 given schools in a given season. And so I can kind of pull from both this kind of like short-term prolific experience of working with 20 to 30 different schools at a time, you know, for like a 6-week summer program, which of course you're in communication with people about for months in advance. And then I can also speak to the more intensive experience of this particular school environment, doing a little, or not little, but much more deeper work there over a longer period of time. And kind of like, that's the perspective I'm pulling from, right, when you ask me that question. So I guess like some of the overarching themes of challenge, I would say, are that kind of the first thing that comes to mind is what you brought up earlier. I mean, teachers are so critical, let me just say that, in any education infrastructure. And when you're trying to bring something that's perceived as new or something fresh and different and innovative into those environments, a lot of times those environments, when we're talking about a CPS school where the teachers are put under so much stress and given hardly enough resources, mostly they're under-resourced and they make magic happen, you know, out of what they're given. But when you're in those environments and you're that person bringing this innovative new thing, or at least what's perceived as that, to them, there's a lot of skeptical energy that you're met with. There's a lot of, you know, what is this? Who are you? Why do you want to bring this here? You know, and you have to get through some of that and have a thick enough skin to have real conversations with people and be like, this is the underlying motivation. This is why we want to introduce this. This is what the children can get out of this experience. And ultimately, you know, how you appeal to those stakeholders that are teachers or principals, administrators, right, is through underlying their bottom line. And that's what I took away from that PR program. Is that you really gotta appeal to the people who you're trying to get to work with you, you know, and really that's what community development is about, and a more authentic level of that, you know. And so how do I end up serving your bottom line as a pressured teacher who's being asked to get these kids to perform at XYZ level with XYZ benchmark by XYZ date, you know, and they're stressed, you know, they are under-resourced. So getting teacher buy-in is a part of that larger winning recipe, and also a part of what you're talking about here is like the challenge aspect. So there's that, and then put that on a plate, you know, off to the side. And then there's also there's also like the administrators. You know, some principals are way cooler and way more willing to work with you than others. Some principals are way more open to hearing different perspectives and points of reason than others. Some principals are there for their ego. some principals are there for the children. And I would say the majority of principals I've worked with are there for some combination of both children and their ego, you know? So there's that. So you have to learn how to work with kind of volatile personalities in order to like bring forward the end game. And keep in mind that these volatile personalities, whether that's in an administrator or a teacher, it's 9 times out of 10, you can attribute that to the fact that they are overworked and over, you know, under resourced at the same time. And so I want to undercase that, and I'll swear I'll keep, or I'll refrain from saying that over and over again, but I just want to like make sure that the audience is aware of that if they're not already, at the amount of pressure that is put on teachers to perform and kind of some of the serious repercussions that can come from them not performing in these very rigid structures of what accomplishment is, given by state mandates, federal mandates, etc. So there's that. That was a challenge. And then, you know, the other last challenge I'll mention, Trent, to your question of just what are the challenges of doing this type of work, right, is ultimately you have to have a garden team, and that team has to consist of both adults and children. And 9 times out of 10, I'll tell you, it's much easier to find children who want to steward these types of garden projects in schools after being experienced, you know, to given that exposure, I should say, to some of those things, than it is adults. Adults are hard to come by to run programs, to keep running programs. Gardens take ongoing work. If you don't think a garden takes ongoing work, think again. And if you don't have, you know, the infrastructure of for the adult staff members or just adult volunteers, whatever, to be there, if you don't have that presence helping to organize the chaos, then it's not going to happen, you know? So that was a big challenge, because a lot of times these people are already overworked, underpaid, underserved themselves, and they're servicing kids who are underserved. So it's just like a vicious cycle. So those are the three main challenges I would kind of put out there, you know, initially.
Mm-hmm. And can you, just to give the listeners some context, can you describe like one scenario where you were like trying to get a specific budget for something or trying to get a certain resource implemented or available to you and your group that you're working with, and where you basically like were met with like a perfect recipe of a storm of resistance and challenge?
Oh my God, there's so many. I feel like I blocked out so many examples. My like coping mechanism is like delete. Like,
oh, I know. I have tutorials on that.
You do, girl. I'm sure you do. I hope that I'll remember those things too that we delete. So let me see. Yeah.
If you could pull it back forward from the archives for the purpose of letting the listeners know, because in this time, especially where there's a climate where people are becoming aware of the divisions and the lack of resources and the lack of opportunity that is present in the low-income communities, especially the Black and Brown low-income communities, it's time for us. I've been having to do that heavy lifting. People have been asking me a lot of questions about my childhood that I don't really want to answer. And like, it's time to do that heavy lifting of bringing this stuff up again, just for the purpose of educating our listeners so that they can understand how they can be productive members of society and creating shifts so that these issues that we're talking about can dissolve.
Gotcha. All right, I'm gonna answer it the best of my capability, and at the end of it, if you need a more specific example, then give me that. Mm-hmm. But I'll say that I think the winning recipe for how our listeners can get traction and results, first things first, I want to say, is through community. There's no shadow of a doubt that every time I was faced with one of these challenges, there was, a whole lot of individual lifting that I was doing, a lot of heavy lifting, but no way, shape, or form could any of the things that I was able to do, which, you know, I'm hoping to do even bigger things by the time I leave this earth, but I am proud of what I have done to date, and none of those things could have happened without working and functioning in community. And that is to say, every time that I was faced with, hey, we don't have enough money for this, through the nonprofit world that I was working in this vein, right, of servicing students who were in CPS environments. You know, every time I was faced with that, there was always some solution that had to be come up with. And sometimes that was, who do I call, you know, what business do I call to see if they can donate plant trays or seeds or whatever, you know. Who do I know who would know who I could call? You know, who do I know who could have some of these resources for this type of programming? And really, the existing networks, you got to function within the existing networks and help create your own new kind of limb off of that community network. And that's how you gain traction. Doing things in solo, in a silo, it's not going to work. You know, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the first thing I'll say. Like, a lot of the challenges were around money, I'll tell you, just transparently, in any climate. The Green Corps program was refreshing because it was like, we got money to spend. You know, it was like, let's go get these new bikes for these kids. Like, all these kids are going to be fresh on these bikes, you know. Like, that was a new perspective. The other perspective is the nonprofit world, when you're not dealing with a city-funded program. And unfortunately, that's the majority of the programs that are out there are small nonprofits. And they are all competing for the same money and the same joke of the pool, the minuscule pool, you know, of funding that is available for these organizations. When you compare that 1% of the world's population has 99% of the economic wealth, and then you go on the other side of that in this post-neoliberal era, which is alive and well, neoliberalism, you know, there ain't funding for community orgs like that. And so I think, like, when I was up with those challenges, it was like, let's reach out to the community in the ways I just gave you. Another example is like philosophy. Like, I want to tell the story of PB and how we transformed the Gale School Garden trend, but I don't know if this is the time.
Yes, this is the time.
Okay. Well, then this is the time, because it's going to bring the viewer, I think, to a happy place, and also listen to some of the challenges that we had to go through, you know, along
the way.
And so this was a one project where, skip ahead to the headline, like, what happened. By the end of the time there, I had built on what my predecessor, Anthony Boatman, had built, and we created, or we had collected over $200,000 in green infrastructure funding in order to transform a school garden that, if memory serves, is 120 foot long by 35 foot wide. So this is like a city lot, in other words, for those listeners who just don't know what that even measures out to. It's like a city lot, you know? And so we brought in over $200,000 over the 2 years that I was there in transformative work. And I want to tell the story of that. And I'm going to try to be as succinct as possible, you know, just for the sake of time. But this is the journey. And it all began with Anthony Boatman. And Anthony Boatman was an incredible community leader. Rest in peace. And he is, his soul is a mentor to those, including me. You know, I hear his voice, you know. I listen to his guidance to this day, kind of thing. But he is an interesting person that I think we need to spend a couple minutes talking about.
Mm-hmm. Please do.
Cool. So he was the previous director of the Genesis Project at this nonprofit, A Just Harvest. And Anthony's history is that he was 2 years old when his mama walked him up to a foster care system, or a, you know, a children's home, whatever you want to call it, and dropped him off at the gate and said she would be back soon, and she never came back. And basically, he grew up in the system of foster care, and he ended up, you know, producing his early adolescent life as somebody who was stealing cars. So he got locked up for stealing cars, you know, hot cars, and that leads nowhere good, because VIN numbers exist, etc. And long story short, he got locked up, went through the prison system. And then came out of that experience changed, though, for the better, because he realized, you know what, I need to intervene where nobody intervened for me. And so he became the dopest mentor I've ever met for community. I mean, I don't think I'm exaggerating, because I really feel that way about him. But he would just talk to kids, you know, at a real level, and kids respected him because of that. And, you know, he became this community leader. He worked with Ceasefire for a long time, which, if the listeners don't know, that's an organization dedicated to getting people to stop shooting each other. So, you know, he was a big mentor in that movement. I think he worked for Becoming a Man and stuff, and Big Brother, all that stuff. He worked for all those orgs. And then he landed at A Just Harvest towards the end of his life. And I knew Anthony, our paths had crossed, because I was working for another nonprofit
in the Peterson Garden Project across from Howard Street, which we're talking about like an iconic era of history on Howard Street alone. You know, there's been so much, what I'm trying to say, there's so much history on Howard Street alone. Mm-hmm. I did a capstone project on this. It's deep, y'all. Like, there's so much history to Howard Street in Chicago on the North End, with different communities, different ethnic groups over the decades, you know, over hundreds of years. But anyway, across from Howard Street on the other end, I was working for Peterson Garden Project, and we did this pop-up community garden, which I'll talk about later, that whole thing, if it becomes relevant. But, you know, the summary is that their mission is to grow long-term gardeners, not long-term gardens, which some people see the wisdom in and other people see the flaw in, because we need long-term spaces where we're growing as a community, mm-hmm. where we can put roots up as a community, where we can plant a tree as a community and have it grow and not just be a box that gets moved when a developer comes in, you know, and puts in something.
Mm-hmm.
So no diss to PGP, but it is, it's a model that serves long-term gardeners, perhaps, but not long-term locations, just to identify from kind of a, you know, objective perspective on that. But anyway, Anthony and I met there at that garden because I was doing event coordination, and they, ironically enough, I landed there because I was doing, through the McCormick Center at DePaul, they fund people to go intern for different nonprofits when the nonprofits can't afford it. And so I was able to intern for PGP, and they brought me in to kind of help, like, liaison between them and the community. And just for, like, the listeners' purposes, like, just some clarifying points, like, yes, I am a white-skinned woman. No, I do not come from a very economically wealthy background. I come from what I identify as humble stock, a blue-collar environment, and I've worked my way through a bunch of different things, and I'm still working my way through a bunch of different things. But my lived experience is that I'm, like, the country kid, and I grew up, like, a real big, fat nerd who everybody made fun of, but I was really smart in school, so the teachers loved me. And, like, I was always kind of on the fringe, and all my friends were just the different kids, so to speak. So I kind of have this history of, like, understanding both worlds. Like, white people look at me and they think I'm white, but, like, most of my, like, long-term friendships have, in fact, been with people who are not white-skinned, and I've learned a lot, therefore, from not only those experiences of being friends with people from those environments, but from my own experience of being ostracized and kind of understanding different levels, which I can never understand at certain levels because my skin is the color that it is. But I do understand levels of it, and therefore that set me up for more success. Also, just a brief, you know, tangent. I have been a spoken word artist. I still identify as that, but I was more active in that. So I was doing a lot of open mics and involved with the hip hop community and different poetry groups and stuff. And most of those scenes, if you're not aware, are led by people of color. So that's kind of like my cultural backdrop to, like, this environment. So this nonprofit was using me as a leverage. And I was happy to be used as this, you know, as a gateway. And basically the point was everybody in the community was looking at our pop-up garden at first. And this is all to get back to Anthony, all to get back to Gail. But they were looking at our pop-up garden like, who is this? Anthony himself is quoted in a newspaper as saying Peterson Garden Project is a gentrification bullet. And that's because before he knew anybody over there, really, he just had a strong sense of what that organization was about. So timeline moves forward. The garden gets put in. I've been this new intern on staff. I'm like, hey, why don't we, you know, this is the stigma from the community. Why don't we do something more integrative? Peterson Garden Project, people are like, you know what, Tanya, that's a good idea. So they allow me to be the events coordinator of this garden in Rogers Park, the second most ethnically diverse community area in Chicago. And there we are, you know, doing events. And I'm like, how do we make this really authentic? So we bring in different hip hop artists who are local. We bring in different bands who are local. And we host open mics and we host movie nights. And I'm standing there on the fence of Howard Street telling people what this garden is, what it's about, how they can get involved. You know, you can become a member by this way. We also have scholarships if you need it. Reach out here. You know, this is how to do it. And at first people were like, okay, you know, they're like, all right, like, looking at me like, who are you? Why are you here? You know, like everybody else, because, you know, these communities are used to people coming in and using them, even though these communities have been put down and so much has been taken from them as it is. They're used to being exploited further. You know, that's how they've originated mm-hmm. in these conditions. So there was a little bit of that at first, but then soon enough, people kept seeing me. You know, they saw me day in, day out. We kept talking. And sure enough, you know, long story short, everybody in the neighborhood knows me. You know, we're all talking. Everybody is welcome in that space. People are in that space who look very different from each other. So you have the stereotypical, you know, white, like, uppity, like, I have money and time to spend, so I'm here. And, you know, notice on those people, because congratulations, everybody should be gardening, you know. But then we also have, you know, the kids from the community who are causing ruckus in the garden and need to be, like, kind of pulled back, and their parents aren't around, so who's there to help? Well, community has to figure out how to deal with that in a non-aggressive way, but a constructive way. So I kind of started to play this role of, like, introducing different people to the garden who did not look like white women, you know what I'm saying? And also helping kind of create, like, a safe environment there that wasn't an environment where the violence that Trinetti pointed out in some of these playgrounds, right, that wasn't going to play out there, but that people felt welcome there, and that we wanted to frame it as a place of peace, you know, really. At least I did. That was my kind of underlying motive. And so anyway, I met Anthony there in that process of these events, in that process of helping gardeners learn how to grow food, because there's a lot of novice gardeners, right? Anthony was there, and he was gardening the AJH plot, and that's where our friendship developed. And long story short, you know, he asked me to do a garden club for Gale School through AJH Harvest. As a part-time thing, and so I did, and then that was cool, and that was kind of like working with these youth, though, was an eye-opener to me. It was definitely the most challenging experience. That first garden club I did, it was designed to work with the kids specifically who had issues sitting in a classroom, and meaning that these were the kids who were disruptive, like literally would stand up and start beating each other up in the middle of a class. These are the kids who were failing and about to drop out. These were the kids who have been multiple times suspended. You know, like, this is the population of, like, and I was working with, like, 6th through 8th grade, mostly at that point. So that was, like, my first real introduction into, like, working with kids in Rogers Park at a more, like, I'm paid to be here level. And that was an eye-opener for me, because it helped me realize just the amount of pain that and suffering that these kids are living with every day, and how that really translates into behavior. And it really helped me get a better understanding of how quickly these judgmental, racist, ignorant people can come to their conclusions about these kids without knowing anything about how they're growing up, how their social structure is. Some of these things you talked about, Trinetti, about gangs and guns and drugs, that's what's happening. These kids are being introduced to that. It's not white America. When even, like, some of the kids I worked with were white-skinned. But, you know, I'm thinking of one kid in particular. He was one of the worst, objectively worst kids. You know, he would cause all these fights and stuff. But he had mental illness, and, like, he had abuse happening at home. And he had drug addiction happening at home, you know. So, like, these things are real in our child's lives. And people don't want to deal with that. They just want to come to their conclusions without dealing with it. So thank you to the listeners, you know, who are listening to this. Thank you for dealing with it, even if you're not from those communities or you are from those communities. Like, thank you for dealing with it, you know? But anyway, some of the challenges, I'll go into the good thing. Fast forward, the not so good thing is that Anthony actually passed away. And he was only 56, and he had a heart attack in his sleep. And, you know, the man ate a lot of animal products. I'll let you figure out how he got heart disease from there. But, you know, he passed away, and it was tragic, and it left a hole. And everybody felt it who knew him, and he knew everybody. So there was that. But, you know, after that, 6 months later, the executive director decided they needed to fill the role. And his title was the director of the Genesis Project. And she decided to ask me to do it. And I was looking for work at the time. And so I took it up, and I was like, this feels aligned, you know, let me do it. So I did it. And in that role, what I had done was build on what Anthony had laid. And there's a reason I want to talk about that. So he started this garden. It was a patch of grass. The city lot on the east side of the school was a patch of grass when he started. And he transformed that patch of grass into a garden. It was a functional garden. And it was a row style garden. You know, there was like a path down the middle and a plot on either side of that path. Just a series of those plots going all the way in this whole stretch. And, you know, the kids used to joke that it was graves because of how it looked. It looked like a freshly packed grave. So, like, you know, that tells you a couple things right off the bat. A, the kids who are in pre-K to 8th grade know what a grave looks like. You know, B, it tells you that there's a stigma around gardening and around working with the earth to kids, and that it's not a good positive stigma. You know, to me at least, those are some takeaways that, you know, you can take away from those kind of jokes from kids. And, you know, see, it shows that they're not authentically engaging with those spaces. And so some of the kids were, though, and like those initial kids I just spoke about, Anthony got a healthy foundation and a healthy history established. He's the one who started getting kids involved in that space, period, point blank. And without that, I don't think we could have done what we did, because he laid the foundation for everything else that came. Those $200,000 that we got invested into that space, that was only possible because of Anthony. Like, yeah, I was there, but without his foundation, without him introducing me to that community, without him bringing me in to be a garden club instructor, you know, when he was the director of the Genesis Project, I don't think any of that would have happened. So I just want to, like, give some, like, shout outs to his soul and recognition of Anthony Boatman, you know.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for acknowledging that. And I want to give some shout outs to your soul, because I witnessed your journey through that process. And I feel like, yes, he laid the foundation, but also the beauty of what you created in that atmosphere also would not have happened if you hadn't been so dedicated and committed and willing to show up in those infernos that you faced when you were working to gather those resources, which wasn't, like, I also want to make it apparent for the listeners, like, it wasn't a pool of money that just appeared all at once. It was something that you chipped away at that ice block with your community over a period of time to gain all of that and bring that energy into the space incrementally. And so, yeah, I just want to bring you back to the nectar of the question, which was, why, like, what were the main key challenges that you faced when you were building that garden? How did you overcome it? And what advice would you give to listeners who are tuning in right now and they're aware of the Black Lives Matter movement and they're wanting to do something and they're wanting to help be a part of the shift? How would you encourage them to do that?
Absolutely. So thank you for that. I think that some of the main challenges, you know, the big chunk, I want to be clear that a big chunk of the money came from participatory budgeting in Rogers Park. And for those of you who don't know what that is, you should. I'm going to just defiantly say that. you should. And let me tell you. So participatory budgeting is when a community decides how that community's money gets spent. And this is a concept that came out of Central America and Southern America. But our alderman in the 49th Ward, Joe Moore, he was the alderman for like 30-something years or something crazy, long time. He did that. And we got on the docket for that so that the community could vote for this garden. And it took a 6-month period, like what Trinetti's talking about, this building of increments. It was a 6-month period before we could even get to the point where we were on a ballot, you know, to be voted on. And so they call it like community championing when you're like leading this project forward, all these discussions. And that's part of it. You know, so that's, anyway, that's how we started with it, though, is, hey, the alderman puts up $1 million every year of the $1.3 million that he gets for us to decide how it gets spent. Why don't we bring some money to Gale School? And then some people initially, just to talk about these challenges in this phase, right? Some people initially were very skeptical. They're like, no, the community will never vote for Gale School. That's something I heard, you know, that's something I heard because of the stigma around the school and who goes to that school and what happens at that school in that region of Rogers Park, you know? And then, so that was a challenge right off the bat. And then we were like, no, we're going to do it. You know, the kids want to do it. The ED approved it. Let's do it. And then throughout that process, more and more people started coming. It was kind of like that, if you build it, they will come thing. So we built a campaign. And, you know, those 2 years in Columbia as a public relations student, it actually served me on a lot of levels throughout this. Because first off, there was a rift between the organization I was working for and the alderman's office. So I had to, like, heal that with some PR zhuzh and make friends with those people, you know, to kind of heal some of those tensions because of the history of pain, which you can draw your own conclusions, whatever. But anyway, then we move forward and we're getting the traction going. And then there's all these community meetings you got to show up to. So for a listener, it's like resilience. Yeah, you know that. If you're a listener, you already know resilience is critical. That's a part of it. Persistence. Persistence is synonymous with success. I like to live by that. I think it's true. So anyway, we move forward. And then finally, we get to the point where like kids can get on the stage and talk about the project themselves and why they want their design that they designed, they drew, why they want that actualized. And that's where the magic happens. When you turn the microphone over to the children and the people who are actually being affected by any given thing or who want to see and or who want to see change move forward, that's where the magic happens, because then you're speaking truth to truth. There's no BS when you're talking to somebody who is living that experience and they want something and they're telling you why they want it. It's their lived truth that they're sharing with you. So that's where I think we gained an incredible amount of support from the community once they saw those kids. And it took some coaxing, you know, it took me to like encouraging those kids and building them up to be like, yeah, you can take this microphone, own this room. These people are here to listen to you, you know, like a lot of that kind of stuff, because kids are shy, and anybody, all of us, we all have an inner kid. We can all be shy, you know, but so that was a part of it, building up the people who needed to be the leaders of that movement to be the leaders of that movement. I think that's part of that challenge. From this perspective, at least, and getting them to where, you know, these kids can actually speak their mind. And so they spoke their mind, and the community came back to support them. We did a strategic guerrilla kind of campaign where we went around. I had like a spreadsheet, and from living in the community for years, like 5 years at least at that point, I had an idea, you know, of the hot spots, like where we needed to really hit. And so there's a high priority, medium priority, low priority, and we hit all of them, even the low priority. And I scheduled like the parents and the kids, you know, to come out and do shifts who wanted to. And we had these little palmlets that said, punch number 8, help us create the Gale Learning Garden. And it was a picture of a sunflower, and the center was the text. And so the kids handed out these palmlets to the people in the community, and they spoke at these community platform events designed to present the different ballot options, you know, to voters or prospective voters. And at the end of that, I have to check my stats. I think it was 34%. It might have been more percent increase. I want to say 56%. I don't know where I'm getting these numbers, but I'm going to go lowball just for the sake of being accurate and possibly understating the significance. I don't want to overstate anything. I would rather understate it. So let's just go with like 34% of people who voted in that voting cycle were people who never had previously voted in participatory budgeting before. So there was a massive, at minimum, a third of the people who voted were brand new PD voters, just to put that data in better perspective, at minimum, to my memory. It could be more than that, but at minimum, it was a third. So that's saying something. That's like 1 in 3 people who voted during that cycle voted because of our garden, is what the alderman's office said to me behind closed doors. If you came back to any one of those staff members and said, did Tanya say that? They'd probably deny it, because like, you're not supposed to tell people stuff like that. But I'm telling our listeners today that that happened. They told me, we think this is because of your project, because of the marketing that the kids did. And so it was like, we saw this massive increase in voter turnout because we saw stewards of our community tell people they needed to show up. And those stewards happened to be children and younger than anybody who could actually vote in the cycle. But they were there telling the people who could vote, all the adults, like, hey, you need to get out to vote, man. Vote for our garden, punch number 8, you know? And so there was a challenge with that, though, because I had to, first off, make sure that our kids felt, as I just said, confident enough to be in that position of leadership. And then B, like, create the infrastructure for them to do that, like the spreadsheet, the time slots, you know, all that. Create the palmlets, print the palmlets, disseminate them to the kids, you know, that sort of thing. Be there with them while they're doing it in case an adult was there to do anything stupid, you know, while the kid's talking with them. So like, there was process to that that I, you know, was a challenge in and of itself. But at the end of it, we ended up winning second place to trees, and there were 4 projects that won with the amount of money that was able to be allocated. So we were only number 2 to planting more trees in the ward, and that was an incredible win for our community. And I had elders come up to me and say, you know, who'd been there their whole lives, say, I never thought I would see the day that any money came through this alderman's office to this school or to this part of town. And, you know, thank you. And, like, that was that kind of experience. But it came with so many challenges. And, like, you know, there was we had to amend relationships. We had to organize people. We had to get different people built up where they felt confident enough to be in those roles. And we had to go against the stigma that this is a school of people who don't care about themselves in that process, and work against that in the community, which largely I think Rogers Park is a very supportive community, you know, but I just want to kind of paint those challenges, you know, for people, because they are real. And you know, in that process, that was very challenging. We also got a grant through Big Green, which was formerly called the Kitchen Community, to put in their portion of the garden. And that was a much easier process. But the challenge in that was the grant writing. And I had a community partner who was a volunteer, Carol Melnick. She's an amazing woman. She put in a lot of volunteer hours, and she wrote what I identify as like the drudgery parts of the grant. And I wrote the like fun parts where I get to talk about the passion and the vision and what we're building, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so the challenge though was finding a volunteer at first for that. So finding resources, you know, how do you, again, I come back to my initial statement, how do you succeed if you're somebody listening to this and you want to build and you want to get beyond whatever you're currently facing? You need to function in community. And the other thing I'm going to add is you need to work with people, or consider, I should say, you need to consider working with people who you don't previously identify as allies. And by that, I mean, you need to figure out who your allies really are, and they might not look like you or live your same experiences. And so that was a process for me. You know, I had to figure out, like, wait, I don't want to work with XYZ people because they feel like this upper class of white bitches who have made fun of me my whole life. You know what I mean? Like, that was, for me, my own hindrance that I had to work through, and let alone I'm trying to protect these kids from whatever. But then I realized there's a lot of people who come from different backgrounds who are thirsty for a way to give back.
Exactly.
Yes. And all they
really want to help.
Yes. Yes.
And would you say, like, something that I'm like feeling inspired and taking away from this conversation and just hearing your story is that, like, for people who are listening to this, who are just now awakening to the fact that there is a need for them to be finding ways to contribute and give back to the community, would you say that it's like, I feel like some people might be afraid to go into a low-income community and say that they want to help, or go and find organizations and say that they want to help? And would you have any suggestions on ways in which they could make a, like, instead of waiting for someone from an organization to come to them, ways that they can go and seek out these organizations that are doing this work and offer help and offer support?
Absolutely. I think for anybody in that boat that you just portrayed, I think just researching what existing organizations are in the community there that you want to work in, that's step one. Step two is going to be figuring out which of those community organizations you feel most aligned with, and also you feel are legit, the most legit. Because there are some fronters out here, and there, and you want to figure out from, usually if you can, you talk to the people from the organizations, of course, but they're paid to do what they're doing. So talk to people, if you can, who have been serviced by those organizations. If you can figure out how to sleuth, like, do you know somebody who knows somebody who's, you know, knows something about that organization that's not paid by that organization to say something? You know what I mean?
Right.
Figuring that out, like, just do your own work to figure out who's already there doing the work and vet them before you approach them.
Exactly. Vetting the organizations before you give your money. I just recently made a post on Facebook about that, about people blindly donating to any organization just because it says, like, hashtag Black Lives Matter. Mm-hmm. And many of those organizations are just like siphons, and they're siphoning that money into political campaigns that don't really actually have anything to do with our communities or making impacts. And people really do need to take that little extra effort to find people who are like you and like Anthony, and are doing that work, building from the ground up and actually in the communities and actually a part of the communities, so that those resources are actually making an impact.
Absolutely, absolutely. And something that people can also contribute beyond just money is time. If you're serious about putting in time over an extended period of time, there's a lot of places that have programming for that kind of person. like roles where you can come in and do certain tasks that they need help doing. So that's another way to give your energy to those initiatives. I hope that answers your question though, Trent.
Yeah, totally answers my question. And another thing that you pointed out that I think is just really important is like the fact that you guys let the children speak and you gave them a voice. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy for adults to get caught up in thinking that they know what's best, that they are carrying the keys and the answers to all of the problems in the world. And really, like,
ain't it fixed? No, I'm just kidding.
Yes, the children are living the most close experience with reality than anyone. Like, the older you get, the more lived experience you have, the more in your head you are, the more like language and stories and reasons you have around why things are the way that they are, and you become more and more like the real, like, visceral experience of presence. And children, like, they are right here. Like, I like to look at it like, here's the womb, and just behind the womb is the portal to the universe or God. So there's God, and then you come through the womb and you're a baby, and so you're still super close to God. And when you're a child, you're still super, super close. And so there's divine wisdom that children carry, and children are able to see a situation and the way that it's playing out in a way that adults are not able to, as we're farther away.
Amen.
And there needs to be more room given for the voices of those children. And instead of adults coming in and being like, let's do this, 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 and that, first coming in and creating these spaces of, what do you need? What would you like to receive? And I bring this up because help can come across as colonization.
Yes, thank you.
When it is not brought into the community in the right way.
Thank
so
you.
For people who are feeling inspired by the movement right now, ask questions. Go into the communities and listen for a long time before you think about doing anything. Because if you just come in trying to do something and trying to teach something and trying to implement something, you are a colonizer.
Yep.
And you don't know if what you're bringing in is actually what is useful or beneficial. And you could be bringing in disease into that community because you don't actually know what the community needs. It's like going and blindly planting like seeds into a forest and not really knowing the ecosystem and not knowing if that plant is actually viable for that environment. And then it invites this pest to come in that like kills all of the old trees,
like
buckthorn. You know?
Yeah.
Yes.
You bring in
exactly.
the buckthorn, people. Listen up. No.
Don't bring in the buckthorn.
Don't bring in the buckthorn. Don't do it.
Don't be a colonizer.
Don't do it.
Like, we are needing to eradicate that energy. And in the first episode of this podcast, Riding with Dragons, I talked about my philosophy around what dragons are. And dragons are many different things. And one of the things that I think that is personified through like the historical representation of dragons is like in the Eastern philosophy, they think of dragons as these gatekeepers of like the like mystical realms of the unknown, of wisdom, of like supernatural and metaphysical power. They're these majestic, all-knowing beings. And in Western mythos, they're these destroyers. They're these hoarders of treasure, and like they come and they burn the village. And the place my mind goes is like, what if that dragon is burning your Western civilization village because it's toxic? When you like move it out to a form of consciousness. And so it's like, as we learn to ride these dragons, like we need to be aware of what we're coming in to do. And our dragon, our main dragon is our mind. So what are you coming in to do? Are you well-intended, but still somehow carrying out the energy of the colonizer, of the oppressor, of the patriarch? Or are you approaching your way of lending service and help from a space of receptivity and invitation and understanding and willingness to go into the unknown and become familiar with something that you have no prior experience with And then once you're familiar, making moves, or are you willing to be directed in those spaces by others who do know what's going on?
Yes.
And so I have a fun question that I want to ask you, Miss Tanya, that I'm going to ask all my dragon riders, is what kind of dragon do you think you are?
Oh my God.
And we're going to, yeah. What kind of dragon are you?
I love this question so much. Oh my God. what kind of dragon am I? But the first thing that came to mind, I'm like the groovy green dragon with vines flowing off of my, like, that. My hair is vines, you know how dragon hair. I think my hair is vines. I got the occasional sunflower and select placed roses with very thorny bushes in case I need to lash that out. I can. It's like on my tail or something, you know. I think that's my dragon. I got turquoise earrings on too, because turquoise is just the vibe. I feel like it's a good dragon vibe. All
right. Yes. That's exactly. I was seeing you as an earth dragon as well.
Yes.
And break it down into like elemental dragons.
Yes.
And how can people find you? What are your current we've been talking a lot about your past projects, but what are your current projects and how can people find you?
Awesome. Yeah. My current projects, I actually have a sustainable landscape design business that I've initiated, and that's called Earth Mama Design. And you can find that at earthmamalandscaping.com. And that's just earth, and then mama is M-A-M-A, landscaping.com. That can tell you more about my work and kind of my inspiration with permaculture as a guiding philosophy. But I do a variety of different edible and non-edible landscapes. But all of my landscapes have pollinator food, because that's critical. 2 and 3 mouthfuls of food and drink, y'all, are from pollinators. Let's just put it out there. And then another project I'm working on is my astrology business. And more than a business, I'm building a platform. And that's what the Wisdom Drops platform here on Anchor and Spotify and stuff. That's what that's about. But I have a YouTube channel as well. And it's Wisdom Drops, all Z's. So you can check that out. And I do astrology readings. I'm actually a long-term student of astrology. I've been studying for 10 years and really hardcore, seriously, for the last 5 years. So
yes,
I do.
Yeah. And astrologer. So if you are an astrologer and you want to learn more about astrology, this is the girl. She speaks the language fully. I like to call her a landscaper of the earth and the stars.
Oh, that's so poetic. See, your poetry of words never fails. Thank you for that summation of my essence. Yes. I am an alien. I'm reincarnated. Greeting, godling.
Well, it's been so wonderful to talk with you about this topic, and we will be having more episodes with Tanya on here, where we'll be doing wisdom drops and talking about specific things with astrology and how that relates to your process of inner alchemy. This podcast is all about learning how to ride the dragon of our mind and of our like ability to manifest and co-create this reality with ease and grace and efficiency. And so everyone that I highlight are people who are brilliant dragon riders in their own right, and their stories are here to inspire you and show you that whatever it is that you think that you want to do, you can do it, and you just have to be resilient and have that perseverance and that focus, that dragon focus, and hop on that dragon and ride it and don't let it knock you off.
Amen.
And that's it for today's episode of Wisdom of Marty and Wisdom Drops World, of Riding with Dragons, featuring Wisdom Drops Miss Tanya, and we will be seeing you in the future. Stay tuned.
I hate to interject, but could I give one last drop of wisdom for those folks out there who are doing this kind of work? I wanted to say to you, if you're listening to this, you're a local inspiration, you're a local hero. Just your energy that you're dedicating to this stuff, no matter who you are, that's hero's work. And I want to just speak to the fact that it's draining. It can be draining.
and you need to take care of yourself. And in order to be persistent, you need to be, your cup needs to be full. So you need to find sources of inspiration, find those anchor people in your life who, you know, you can get more energy from because you're building energy together, giving energy to each other. Find those people and vibrate, work with them, work with that. Find the inspiration in your own community to keep going, because you're going to need it. And thank you for letting me say that. And thank you
for saying that. That is a beautiful way to close the container, and definite wisdom that is needed, because babies, the journey is just beginning. This is the beginning of the shift. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. So take that time, run a bath, have some tea, go camping, pace yourself. Always pace yourself, because remember, this is a group effort and you're not climbing this mountain alone.
Yes.
And with that, we will close this portal for today. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Riding with the Dragons, featuring Tanya from Wisdom Drops. And we love you. Peace.
Peace.